Hey, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. We are in the Showcase studio. This is the WGN, as if you haven't heard, is moving out of the tower. And we, myself, Ben Anderson, Roger Badish, and Aubrey Mumpower, and I have refused to move. So we're just sitting in the Showcase studio until they throw us out. But it's a full show tonight, and it begins with a guy who wrote me a note saying, as many people do, hey, Rick, I've written a book, and can I send it to you? And I said, yes. And the book came, and Paul Tiotto, it's a relatively thick book, but it's not the thickest book I ever read. And I started reading it, and it is an unbelievably quick, compelling read. It's called Pasta Man, and I have to think, there's a lot of you in this book, is there not? I mean, you grew up on the South Side. Your parents ran an Italian deli, and it's called Pasta Man. What can I tell you?
The book is not an autobiography, but I will say that a lot of the characters in the book, and as you know, there are a lot of characters in the book,
oh,
and a lot of the scenes in the book are, if not true, very similar to things that I've experienced.
You had a long career in healthcare before becoming a novelist and before becoming a spoken word performer, which we'll talk about too, a storyteller. What compelled you to sit down and it's an ambitious undertaking to say, well, I think I'll write, and I don't care if you're retired, I don't care if you were between jobs. It's a very ambitious thing to sit down and try to tell a kind of coming-of-age story set in 60s Chicago. What was a compelling factor for you?
Well, initially, I just enjoyed writing. And when I say initially, it goes all the way back to when I got into college, which was a surprise to me.
And your parents?
And to everyone in my family. I was the first person in my family, and I don't mean like immediate family, I mean any relative,
wow,
that ever went to college. I went to college. I took a number of classes. My best friend was an English major who happens to be the editor of the book.
Mm-hmm. Who you give incredible credit to. Very few novels, in my experience, say by so-and-so with, except for James Patterson. You're following in the footsteps of James Patterson with Bill Clinton and stuff
like
that.
I read that this morning. I should be so lucky.
Yeah.
And my buddy Tom. I met him in 1969. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have graduated college.
Where was college?
Knox College, Galesburg, Illinois. He was, in a way, my interpreter. And I felt like a fish out of water when I went to college. And he was an English major, and he said, why don't you take a writing class? I took a couple of writing classes. I loved it. I graduated from college. I had the opportunity to go to Iowa for the Creative Writers Workshop.
Did you really?
And
well, that's a hard thing to get into. You must have submitted some very interesting, polished stuff to even be asked to get in.
Well, I had the opportunity, and I went back to the South Side and went to work at Canfield's Pop, and then I graduated to Meisterbrau Brewing, and then finally I got a job in the real world using my psychology degree, and that's when I started to matriculate into healthcare. Didn't really start writing.
What scared you off? What scared you off the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
I thought.
Were you feeling insecure about your writing?
No, I was more insecure just about being with a bunch of people who were smarter than me, who were more intelligent, more intellectual. Even though I graduated and it wasn't difficult to graduate, I consistently felt a bit out of place. When I first got to college, I was talking to some of my classmates, except for my friend Tom. Their parents were doctors, lawyers, and my dad was a hardworking factory guy, and my mother...
Were your parents immigrants or your grandparents?
No, my grandparents were immigrants. Yeah. My parents came here, I believe, if we speak to my... Well, my parents have passed away. I think they came here in the womb.
Okay, well, that's good. That makes them kind of immigrant,
right,
doesn't it?
Right.
Doesn't it? Were they proud of you?
Very. My mother and father were very proud of me. My father in a rough and tumble way, and my mother in a classic Italian way. I mean, I could have committed 42 murders, and my mother would have said, oh, he's a good boy.
This book, Pasta Man, is, I'm going to tell people, it is 770-some pages, but I am also telling you people that it reads so fast, and that you have a real narrative drive, and a great, great part of the book is dialogue. I mean, I would say, I'm making a rough estimate having read it, 90% of the book is told in dialogue.
A significant part of the book is dialogue. When I write, I hear people talking, and so it's easier for me to write dialogue than it is to write narrative.
Yeah,
I rush through narratives at times to get to dialogue so I can feel a bit more comfortable.
Yeah. Do you hear, when you create these characters, and there are dozens, I would say, in the book, I want to know specifically, talk to me about the character of Roseanne.
Roseanne is a young girl who catches the eye of Tony, the main character, early on, probably 7th, 8th grade. She is a new girl from a different neighborhood, so that adds a certain sense of mystery to her. And she infatuates Tony. He's obsessed with her. There's a scene after they sort of court each other where he pushes himself upon her, and she decides that she doesn't want him to, which creates a driving force through a large part of the book where he is attempting to apologize to her and win her back.
Paul, when you were writing this thing, how did you write it? I mean, coming to a novel after a career in other things and even loving writing is a hard thing. It is for me, and I've been doing it my whole life, and it is for, you know, it drove Hemingway nuts, and I don't think it drives James Patterson nuts, but it drives a lot of people nuts. It is a very, did you write every day? Once you committed to this thing, was it an everyday kind of habit you had?
I wrote every day, and I had a writing coach. And unfortunately, the writing coach passed away. And so about 6 or 7 months went by before one of his students picked up his business and contacted me and some of his other former students. And I returned to the writing class, and that's kind of when I put my foot to the pedal. And it was every day, a couple times a day. And then when my friend, Tom, got involved in editing it, it was every word at least 3 times.
Really?
Three times through the book, every single word. And we cut, I'm embarrassed to say this, we cut 20% out.
You did?
Yes.
Then it couldn't have been published.
No.
It would have been 1,000... It would have been your first 1,000-page novel. When did you know you were finished with this book? When did you say to yourself, because that process can kind of drag on too, when you're going back to revise and going through with your friend Tom Myers to update, and you're not happy with something you wrote 5 months ago.
Right. Before... The book came out last August, so just about a year ago, 10 and a half months ago. Last January, February, we were done, and we felt that we had what we wanted. We had cut back 20%. We had gone through it from an editing perspective. We really felt like we captured the voices that we wanted to capture. We really feel that we nailed the ending, and that sounds a bit arrogant, but
no,
we really feel that we nailed the ending, and we introduced characters in the beginning of the book, and we stayed with them. So at the end of the book, in the last 30 pages, you pretty much know what everybody's doing and how they played the role through this 8-9 year time period.
Well, you also really nailed the era, too. I will tell you that. You really nailed the era. And what you also nailed, and one of the reasons I cannot read a portion of the book, you nailed the language of this city in a place and time. I mean, it is, the language is tough. It's not made for, well, maybe we could bar the door and I could just start reading it, but it's tough. But this is the way people talk.
My friends, my classmates, and my family, except for some of the women, not all the women, talked like that. I heard their voices, I heard their words as I was writing the dialogue.
The book is Pasta Man by Paul Teodo. This is an interesting name. Where in Italy are your family from?
My mother's family is from Sicily, and my father's family was from Piemonte, which is up near Lake Como and near Milan.
It is a real Chicago book. We're going to take a break, and I'm going to ask him how it was to see it between... Well, first of all, it's hard to get a book published, you'd say, so congratulations on that. The voice of Ella Fitzgerald, because she was one of Roger Badish's old girlfriends many, many years ago before he was married. Welcome back to After Hours. We have a few more minutes with Paul Teodo, who, along with his pal and kind of writing mentor, Tom Myers, has written a very, very compelling, fast-paced novel. Pasta Man is the title of that book, and it is... You know, there's a lot of, you know, tough, if not quite, well, there's some violence in here, but it's balanced with a lot of humor, too. Did you sense that as you were writing it? And again, back to the language being the language in which the way people talk, did you ever say to yourself, oh, man, maybe I'll take out that one beep and that one beep? Did that occur to you? Because it felt so real to me that I would have argued against it if it did.
Well, I got feedback from various people, whether they be classmates in my writing class, my writing coach, or other people who read some of it as it was about to be published. And they said that the language was both raw and gratuitous.
I didn't think that, but go ahead.
But they also said it fit the time.
And place.
And place. And so I decided to leave it in and see how it played, so to speak. And it's playing because every time I do a book club or discuss it with people, the language is always one of the issues.
No question.
Some people say it turned me off, and some people say it fit, and some people say they didn't like it.
They didn't even notice it. Some people didn't even notice it. That's right. The way I talked my whole life. That's the way I talked. I don't want to make too much of the name of the central character, but Tony Tormenti. Tormenti is a very interesting last name. Symbolic or not?
It was a play on
sure.
A word.
I mean, but I find him, you know, as a young man growing up in Chicago, I find him less. I don't find him tormented as much as I find him kind of as confused as all young men are.
He's confused and he's scared.
Yeah,
and the way he reacts when he's confused and he's scared, he lashes out.
Yeah,
sometimes at other people, and as you read in the book, sometimes at himself.
Oh yeah,
and he lashes out hard.
Yeah.
Very hard.
No question.
Without a lot of thinking about what's going to occur subsequent to him lashing out.
Yeah, he trusts his instincts for good and bad,
right,
shall we say.
Right.
Thank God he has some priests in his life, too, which he does, because there are priests all over the book. When in this whole process, and maybe it was even before, you have performed at the Moth, you are a spoken word storyteller.
I am.
When did you start that? Because I think there are a number of things... I would love, and I may, when you're appearing at the Great Centuries in Sluis, Augie Alexie's great bookstore in August, and I may even come see you, because I bet you can read the hell out of this book, as they say. When did you start performing? Because that's another interesting sort of facet of writing.
I was seeing a woman who had heard about the Moth. I had never heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you have a great voice. And she had heard me, because we were professional colleagues and we were also partners.
Yeah.
She had heard me public speak. And she said, you would do a great job at The Moth.
And you said, what's The Moth?
I said, what's The Moth? And I looked it up, and I went to a moth at a place on the north side. I think it's called Martyrs.
Yeah, sure, on Lincoln Avenue.
They pulled my name out of a hat, and I told a story about me and my buddy Tom killing about 13 sheep in Utah after a rousing weekend in Tijuana, and I won. I then was asked to compete in what's called the Moth Grand Slam, which is sort of like the city championship.
Sure.
I won that. They flew me out to New York City. I was honored to sit with Martin Scorsese and then present at what's called the Moth Ball in New York City. It was on the presentation was on CBS this morning.
Yeah, right.
People
right.
The next day at work on that Sunday morning, and I didn't know it, started talking to me.
I saw you in New York.
I didn't even know about it.
When was that? How long ago did you get up on stage at Martyrs?
That was probably 7-8 years ago.
Really? Before you even began this?
Before I began the book, correct.
Very interesting, because for The Moth, you have to write presentational stories, unless you have the world's greatest mind and can just spin it out of your mind, right?
I just do it off the cuff.
You're kidding.
No, I don't write it out. I don't practice. I just kind of let it come. I mean, I've had a lot of stories.
Yeah. Well, you can hear. Go to moth.org and search for Paul Teodo, T-E-O-D-O, and you can hear a fascinating six-minute piece that is or may be true, may not be true. It is true, he is saying. It is about a time he was hitchhiking back to college and got picked up by the noted crazy serial killer John Wayne Gacy. That was off the cuff. That was from memory, not written.
Well, that's a very vivid memory.
Oh, no question. Yes, what was in his backseat? Oh, there was a clown mask in the backseat. I saw a clown mask back there. Getting a book published these days, Paul, is very, very difficult. This is a very, very unnurturing publishing environment. How hard was it to get Pasta Man published?
Well, to be honest with you, Rick, I sent it to a few places, and I never got a response.
Yeah, that's...
So then I took some money out of my bank account and self-published.
Good for you.
I figured if I would wait like some authors wait 10, 15, 20 years to get their book published, I'd be dead.
Well,
I'm 67.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really smart thing to do. And it's a handsome book. It's thick, but it reads like a dream. I mean, this is like the perfect beach book, especially for a Chicago beach. Get onto the 57th Street Beach and read it down there, the 31st Street Beach, or even the Oak Street Beach. You think you got another one in you?
I'm writing another one right now. I'm about 80 pages in, and it's about the South Side of Chicago. It's about a guy who gets fired from a job and goes to a different job.
How empowering is this to see this book between covers? I mean, to know that you pulled it off, to know that you and your pal, and I'm giving him a lot of credit here too.
He deserves it.
Tom Myers have pulled this off. That you have written a 700-page novel and are working on it, just to see and do, and the comments on the Amazon book buying page are 90% 5-star reviews, more than 20 reviews. I truly mean this. I was enthralled by this book. One guy says, I finished Pasta Man in two weeks ago. I thought he said in 2 weeks, because I was going to say, hey, it only took me 2 days. That kind of thing is empowering, is it not?
It is. It's really very, very affirming. I mean, I wrote the book to entertain,
yeah,
to educate, and to inspire. And not to make a bunch of dough. I mean,
sure.
I know I'm not going to make a bunch of dough.
Of course not.
But it's something that I really have always wanted to do, and it was way more time-consuming and way more challenging than I thought. So it was a good, cold bucket of water in the face.
Yeah.
But it really is one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done.
Well, congratulations. And are you still performing? Are you still doing Moth stuff? Because that kind of gratification is instantaneous.
That's instantaneous. I still do a lot of storytelling all over the Chicago area. I did a show last week. I'm doing a show this Thursday night.
Where?
In Arlington Heights. It's called First Person Live. And I'll be up on stage with about 7 or 8 other people. We all take our turns. And I'm telling a story about an experience I had when I was a kid with our Italian delicatessen.
That sounds fascinating. Have you thought to, they're recorded, I mean, the Moth stuff is recorded, to one day take the however many you've done and try to weave those into a book? Because that Gacy story is a very compelling one. It's only 6 minutes long, but 6 minutes translates probably to about 30 pages.
Well, the first part of the Gacy story is in the book.
Yeah,
because
right.
Because the main character
right.
does
of course.
Experience something. The Gacy thing, maybe someday in a book, but not at this time.
You will be appearing at Centuries and Sleuths in August. The book, again, is Pasta Man. The author is Paul Teodo, T-E-O-D-O, with Tom Myers, the guy who got him to take an English class in college. Paul, it's a pleasure to meet you, and congratulations.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for sending it to me. We got to take a little break here because we still do commercials. You're pointing, oh, no, we're not. We have no commercials. Roger Badish has decided no commercials here. I think that's just fine. That's the way I like to operate. We've taken over this station. Look at these guys out here. Oh, hi. Hi. I never do this down here because I don't like people. Ella Fitzgerald, she is in the studio with us here at After Hours with me and Aubrey Mumpower and Roger Badish. She refused to do the show upstairs. She just wanted to do the showcase.
Well, when you have an audience outside the
windows. That's true, yes. I cannot tell. I am going to tell. Many, many years ago when I started doing the Sunday morning version of this show, which was called the Sunday Papers, I said, well, do it from the showcase studio. It'd be really fun. And I thought, wow, it'd be fantastic. I'll be able to see the city and talk to all these wonderful people who would be walking by. I forgot that it was 6:30 in the morning. So I do it, and the first one is horribly boring, and not the show, but the scene outside. Mm-hmm. And the second one, I am confronted with a man standing under the mic at 6:30, and I say to him, I figure out, or someone, Aubrey, helps me figure out how to talk to them outside, and it's fascinating crosstalk, and as I start to talk to him, I realize that he is in a terry cloth robe, and he has a, you know, one of those hospital bracelets on.
Oh, lovely.
So, hi, sir. Good morning, sir. How are you? What do you think of the Sunday paper so far? And he starts swearing, so I... Why, did you hear that?
Fireworks.
Oh, fireworks. I thought it was the Tribune Tower collapsing. So he starts swearing, so Aubrey, whoever, Bob Ferguson turns off the mic, and then he opens his robe.
Oh, hello.
He is totally naked.
Hello, nurse.
And he proceeds to urinate all over the window.
Oh, lovely.
And I remember telling Mary June Rose, I said, I'm not doing the showcase studio anymore. She says, well, why not? And I tell her this story. She goes, well, that's not likely to happen every day. And I said, but I'm so traumatized that I have to give it up. So we've done it upstairs. I've been in here, you know, for Steve's show and Rose show and some other guest appearances. Uh-huh. I want to tell you that Marianne Ahern will be on Steve's show tomorrow at 7:10 with all the stuff that matters. I'll tell you more about people being on Steve's show. Roger, how are you holding up?
I'm doing great.
Really?
I'm feeling wonderful.
You like it down here?
I love it down here. I actually, and I've been mentioning to people, I feel so isolated up in the newsroom by myself and having to look at people through the TV monitor, the cameras that we have here. But down here, I just feel more relaxed, more at ease, and it's wonderful. I'm not distracted by the people outside.
Right. There aren't that many.
Earlier.
Yeah.
Like, the constant flow
now
of humanity.
You have seen. I know that some shows have broadcast from the new studios. Have they not?
No, not yet.
Starts tomorrow?
Well, news will start at 2 a.m. from there. Vic Vaughn start at 2 a.m., but the regular shows will still be down here for about another week or so.
Oh.
And then everyone, within 2 weeks, everything should be over there. from what I've heard.
You've seen it, though.
Yes, I have.
And what do you think? Tell the listener. It's it right across the river. We can't give you the address.
Yeah, 303 East Wacker.
It's a secret.
It's a secret. You didn't hear it from me.
There's no showcase studio. 303 East Wacker Drive. 18th floor. So you're going to have an incredibly hard time getting in. it's nice, isn't it, from what I hear?
It really is.
And what about your area?
It's huge. The newsroom is huge. We've added, I want to say, 5 recording booths.
What is it? What's a recording booth?
Well, it's like a little...
Mr. Radio, yes.
It's like a little recording room, very small, with, you know, sliding door or opening door, whatever. And so people can go in there. We can do our news recordings in there. Podcasts can be recorded in there. You can do telephone interviews in there. So it kind of, instead of being in the large room where the main news desk will be and the other desks, the work desks, will be, you can go in there and kind of not make enough noise to, you know, interrupt the broadcast or anything. But, yeah, it looks great. And it really is. It's about twice the size of the one upstairs.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this whole studio setup upstairs was about, I thought, and Aubrey, you did too, I think, at one point, was about as state-of-the-art as any radio station is going to be, because in years it'll all be able to be done from a phone or something.
Pretty much.
Do you feel any sadness, wistfulness leaving the tower?
Oh, yeah. Why? I mean, well, you've been here a lot.
Yes.
A lot indeed, longer, indeed. But longer.
Yes, a lot longer.
A lot longer. I've been here about 11 and a half years. But growing up in the city, being born and raised in the city, this is an iconic place. I know the term is used too often, iconic, but it is. And I don't think it's necessarily a feeling of melancholy that I won't be coming here every weekend to do my job.
Right.
Because, you know, we get in patterns and we like patterns.
Sure.
But I think it's the fact of why we're moving and what this building will eventually become. Even though we'll still have the facade, which I think is protected.
Oh, yeah, no question. Facade, you know, and lobby. Yeah,
so that'll be protected, and that's all the public will get to see. But then the inner workings will have been gutted.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we'll feel bad about it. But I think the new condo owners, when they come in, will be happy. And God bless.
Well, they'll be happy. They'll go, hey, I bet this is where Steve Cochran used to take naps. Or, hey, I bet this is where Mike Royko used to smoke cigarettes.
There you go.
It is interesting.
Should put plaques around in the different condos. They should do that.
I don't know if that would increase or decrease the value to know, yes, the Royko, yes, you can buy the fourth floor condo at the new whatever. I wonder what they're going to call this, Tribune condos or what condos. The fourth floor apartment in the Tribune condo building,
once
available for $7 million, you can have in there the very place that Mike Royko used to smoke cigarettes.
There you go.
Wouldn't that be funny? I have mixed emotions about this place.
How many years, decades have you been here now?
Pushing 30 years on staff, but a few years before that. But even more interestingly, my mother walked in this building and got a job here in 1937 when she just turned 18 years old.
Wasn't that like 3 years after the building?
No, it was 24.
Oh, that was 24.
But still pretty early.
Yeah.
And then my father worked here for a time. I found some old stories that he had written for the Tribune. One fascinating story about a killer named Bernard Knifey Zawicki in 1940.
Wow.
And the story is he quotes the guy in the lead of the story saying he's accused of killing like 5 people.
Ooh.
He's 18. And he goes, I don't care. I don't care if they were good or bad. I killed them. I killed them all. It's okay if I get the electric chair. I didn't think I'd live to be 21 anyway. I'm saying you could not make up a quote like that. You could not make up a quote like that. And then my brother worked here for a short time. So this is my...
This is your home.
I don't have any family members other than those guys. Yeah, it really is. And I wonder what my father would think or mother would think. But I'm writing a big piece about it for next Sunday.
I can't wait to read it.
So who knows? Aubrey, let's take a break now. We'll see if we're expecting a couple people in here. Maybe they got the date wrong, or I got the date wrong, or they, you know, tied them up when they walked in the lobby or something, or shot them when they tried to get in the parking lot. So we'll take a break now and try to find these nice people.
We can't go on this way, laughing at love day.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is Ella Fitzgerald. If only she were live in the studio. Never did meet her. Never saw. I can't remember how I even saw her. But this is After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, and my buddy Roger Badish is sitting here delivering the news, and Aubrey Mumpower is sitting here engineering, and Ben Anderson's in there producing. And if you're anywhere near the Showcase studio, come see the last dates. We might actually be the last show on. Don't you think that's possible? Not today.
No.
Not today, but next week.
This might be your last show. Well, you might still be here next weekend. I'll be over.
What? I will refuse to do this show. I was expecting to have in, and I probably screwed it up somehow, Penelope Rosemont and her husband Franklin to talk about a three-day event, Thursday through next Sunday, four-day event, called Revolutionary Imagination, Chicago Surrealism from Object to Activism. It is a... It is celebrating the 1968 Chicago Surrealist protest show that was something of a unbelievable sensation back in the day. It's exhibitions, it is film, it's a history lesson, it's theory, it's manifestos, poetry, music at various locations throughout town. Thursday, it's at the Cochran Woods Art Center on South Greenwood. I'm going to have a number of people speaking there. Then Friday, the Arts Club of Chicago, which is just around the corner from here, 201 East Ontario Street, is going to have a mad poetry salon with Penelope Rosemont and some improv from the one and only neo-futurists. Then Saturday, the Study Chicago at 1837 West Fulton Street will have great filmmaker Tom Palazzo, who is... made some astonishing things. One, I think he is the guy who did the wonderful documentary about the sort of death of Maxwell Street. Then cartoons from Bill Holman from the 30s and 40s, University of Chicago. Everybody is involved in this. You can get all the information you need by going to Dada Chicago, D-A-D-A Chicago. com. And coming in here at 10 o'clock is Russ Bradbird. He will be spending at least 45 minutes with me talking about his remarkable book. I've known Russ for a while, and I interviewed him some time ago on another station about his novel. But his latest book, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, A Story of Hoops and Handguns on Chicago's West Side, is chilling. It's sad. It's a very sad cover if you look at it. But I think somewhere in there are some nuggets of real hope. Roger Badish, how's your book coming? Because I got to book you before all these other jokers here.
You are first, no matter what.
How's it coming?
I'm still on the section on my cancer. I'm at 78 pages.
Well, that deserves space, because I know what that was like for you.
Yeah, and what I'm finding is, I've already told you about the uniqueness of the book and where I'm finding a lot of my source material, because my mind is like a steel trap. Once something comes into it, it leaves and my brain shuts down. So I don't really remember a lot, which is why I'm using some online diary services to
sure
as I go along every day, and so I have to actually go back and read what I wrote, and then that triggers other memories that I may not have written about. So as I'm posting reprints of what I wrote, I get to a spot like, oh, you know what's missing to put this into context? And then I start writing paragraph after paragraph of, in other words, it's triggered that memory, which was, I may or may not have repressed.
Was writing about the cancer thing hard for you?
It has been hard. Some of the teaching stuff has been hard, very emotional because of some of the stuff that I went through. But the cancer stuff, there was actually one night I was posting, I was copying and pasting some of the stuff, and I had to stop. I had this overwhelming feeling in myself, just like I was suddenly reliving it. I had to walk away.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. This book is going to be something. I know I always ask you. And
I know. It's going to be long. I didn't think.
Well, look, but look at this.
Look at,
you look at the guy we had on.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Pasta Man.
Yeah.
Do you hear this now? Pasta Man, the novel by Paul Teodo with Tom Myers, is, I'm going to get you the exact number.
A very lengthy tome,
yes,
as they say.
And the printing is, it's 769 pages.
Jeez, I'll never make
and
that.
And you could just take this, put your picture on the front, and call it Radio Man.
I could.
Do you have a working title yet? I asked you that, but I'm going to ask you that every week.
I do, and I'm sure it'll change.
What is it now?
Not, well,
oh, okay. You
yeah,
don't want
I'd
to
rather
say.
Not right now.
It's My Friend Rick. Would that be a good title?
Exactly. Rick told me to write this book, so I did.
Rick found my stories fascinating and made me write this book. That's great. It's going to be published by friends that we know.
Yeah.
Arby, while we wait for 10 o'clock to come, why don't we play Ella Fitzgerald singing Stairway to Heaven, which is really one of my favorite songs of hers. Can we do that? Thank you. Arby is very quiet tonight. Because we're in the Showcase studio.
Let's build a stairway to the stars and climb that stairway to the stars with love beside us to fill the night with the song. We'll hear the sound of violins out yonder where the blue begins. The moon will guide us as we go drifting along. Can't we still wave on a lazy daisy pedal over the rim of the hill? Can't we still on a little dream and settle high on the crest of a thrill? Let's build a stairway to the stars, a lovely, lovely stairway to the stars. It would be heaven to climb to heaven with you.
That was Ella Fitzgerald, and here is Ella Fitzgerald again. Stay tuned, please, though, for Russ Bradbird is going to be in here, and we're going to talk about Chicago. This is How High the Moon. That was Ella Fitzgerald. I'm Rick Cogan. Please stay tuned for part two of After Hours. That's the voice of Ella Fitzgerald. Mine is the voice of Rick Cogan. Welcome to After Hours with me. We're in the Showcase studio. What do you think of this, Russ Bradbird? You
like good
this?
Music.
Yeah. Yeah. So good music, idiot host. What are you going to do? Your latest book, we met each other after you had written a novel,
yes.
And which I admired tremendously. But this book, pal, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, A Story of Hoops and Handguns on Chicago's West Side, is a remarkable book. The story of, it is in many ways, Russ, the story of you, as well as a young man who you coached, who became the victim of, yet another victim of gun violence in Chicago. Since I'm going to keep you on for almost this entire hour, I'm going to start here, where you write, although I never played a minute of varsity basketball in high school, I played on the Frosh Soft team, and I knew even then what drew me to the game, that it was a window into black culture. Expand on that for me, Russ, will you? And welcome to the show, and it's great to see you.
Thank you, Rick. Yeah, it's good to see you again. Well, I think that, you know, I went to Chicago Public Schools for 11 of my 13 years, but when I got to Von Steuben High School, it had been integrated by busing. It was called permissive transfers back then. There were kids from the Austin district, and they were West Side kids.
Yeah.
And to a person, they were just really remarkable guys. They were, you know, interesting and smart and funny, and they had cool nicknames, and they were just really great to be around. And I immediately sort of identified with them and just felt like, geez, I just felt at home with them and felt happy and comfortable with them.
You know, it's a very interesting thing that the same kind of thing happened to Kevin Koval, who's a leading poet in town.
Sure, he does the Louder Than a Bomb.
Who could have created Louder Than a Bomb, who has the People's History of Chicago's latest poetry book. He was something of a hotshot basketball player in Northfield and wound up and knew no black kids, certainly no inner city black kids growing up in Northfield, and wound up, I guess, as a junior in high school coming down to Doug Collins' basketball camp where he was exposed to black Chicago, and it had a profound effect on him. You weren't a good player, but yet you became a coach. How does that happen?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, any just as any writer is someone who loves to read, and I think nearly all coaches were players who just couldn't imagine getting a real job. That's how I was. And so I just loved the game and liked being around kids and couldn't imagine doing anything else for a long time. But I think even from an early age, Rick, I was more interested in the stories than I was in the statistics or the plays, or I don't remember scores or statistics or out-of-bounds plays or zone offenses, but I remember the stories that were attached to things, and I think that's what I think eventually pulled me into the writing life.
Well, I also think you're a born storyteller, too. I mean, just this book is just, and thank God you're going to be here for an hour because we'll get into it. You became a coach, the youngest coach in the history of the Chicago Public League.
That's right. I went to North Park College where I scored 13 career points in Division III.
You mean your picture's not on the wall there,
no,
Russ?
No, not at all. But they were great teams, and I got the bug pretty early. I wanted to be involved in basketball early. And at that time at Von Steuben, they had transferred the coach out at the last minute, and it was October, and somehow they'd transferred a coach out. And so I'd heard there was a coaching opening, so I just went and introduced myself to the principal and said, look, I just played right across the river is North Park. They're literally 300 yards apart. And talked him into letting me have a chance.
Coached by proximity. Then.
Well, that's right. Yeah, they knew who North Park was.
The neighborhood coach.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And so it opened the doors for me. And Von Steuben wasn't so much different then. It wasn't that many years later that I was there.
This book, your book, All the Dreams We've Had, focuses on the west side of Chicago and specifically Marshall High School, the storied, another storied basketball power. Your first brush with Marshall was unfortunate. You lost by 63 points.
Didn't go well, but it was the mayor's tournament, and I remember it at one point counting the players. I thought they've got six guys on the court, and how can this be? And I count 1, 2, 3, but it was five of them, and they were swarming and quick and cohesive. And it wasn't just my players that couldn't figure out their press; I couldn't figure it out either. So I was always a little bit enamored with Marshall. It was the worst defeat I've ever been associated with, probably by 30 points.
It could be the worst of any coach.
It was embarrassing. And Luther Bedford, of course, the coach who later appeared in Hoop Dreams, he was the coach at Marshall at that time.
The main, one of the, I think, two main characters in your book, Sean Harrington, had his 15 minutes of fame as kind of a minor player in the legendary documentary Hoop Dreams made by Steve James here for Kartemkin Films. When did you first meet him?
When did I meet Sean Harrington?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I was doing a scouting service. In the early 90s, I was doing a scouting service, which was like a newsletter.
A subscription kind of newsletter.
Dave Kaplan was my only competitor, and he was already sort of, you could tell, he had his eye on bigger and better things than writing a monthly newsletter. And so I was doing a scouting service, and I remembered Marshall, and, you know, from that shellacking that they gave me, and it was easy to get to. I was living right off Kedzie, where North Park is, and I could just zip down Kedzie and see Marshall against Westinghouse, Marshall against Manley, Marshall against Whitney Young. So I was at Marshall, and I thought it was a good gauge to see how good the teams were that I was scouting. And that's when I first saw Sean Harrington play. Basketball fans would remember that team as they had a 6'2" center, and at the time King High School had this couple 7-footers, and Marshall took him into overtime, nearly beat them. But Sean was clearly sort of the brains and the heart of that team.
Yeah. Yeah. How were you at the time treated as a white person going into those neighborhoods? There was always, when I was a kid, and it was in the 60s, and I would go to, you know, the tournaments at the old amphitheater and stuff, it was, if you were going for ball, you were going for ball.
Yes.
And you didn't get hassled at
yes.
all.
I think I've never once had any trouble going into the West Side or South Side or North Side neighborhoods. And I think part of it is just, you know, the way you handle yourself and the way you walk and talk. And I don't look, you know, I didn't look scared, but I didn't look overconfident or cocky. I just never had any trouble. I think some of that is overblown, although maybe things have changed since I was in the business. But I never had any trouble. And I think because I could talk the talk, you know, I had gone to Chicago Public Schools, had coached in the Chicago mm-hmm. Public League, and I could talk about ball. There was plenty I couldn't talk about, but I think I understood the kids and what they'd been through and what they were going through. And there's something about, you know, public league credentials that I think go a long way.
After you and Kaplan had your mano a mano, and you decided, well, this isn't really, I'm not going to make a living doing this, you decided to go back to coaching, right?
That's right. And that's when the New Mexico State job opened. I'd been coaching at University of Texas El Paso at
yeah.
UTEP, and we had a long list of Chicago players. But then when the job came open at New Mexico State, it was Gar Forman who left, who's now the general manager of the Bulls.
Right.
And so I took Gar Forman's job. And immediately, you know, any recruiter thinks the first thing you need, we got to have a point guard. And I immediately, within hours of taking the job, I called Sean Harrington.
He said I began phoning Sean at his junior college a few days after I started in Mexico State. The one thing about Sean Bradford, about Sean Harrington that you, Coach Bradford, as he calls you, you sensed right away, you have one line in here that says, Sean was unusual, a genuinely warm, decent, and welcoming guy, as opposed to what?
Well, most Chicago players that I coached were hard, tough, gritty, edgy guys. And that carried over off the court often, too. But Sean could kind of turn it on and off, as he was, you know, he could be feisty and tough on the court. And then just the minute practice was over, the minute the games were over, it was, you know, he'd call it, I love you, man, give guys hugs in the locker room. And, you know, it was surprising because it could come off as corny if you didn't know how genuine he was.
What, at the time, did you know much about his family?
No.
You really didn't.
No, no. And of course, his mother was still alive then, which we'll get to, I suppose.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I knew he was from a single parent home, but which was typical, and you know, but he was a genuinely caring guy. And another example, Rick, is he'd go to the girl. I remember going to the women's game at New Mexico State once, and I showed up late because I didn't go to all of them. And there he was leading the, you know, stomping and getting
right,
everyone to stomp
right,
and cheer in unison. Right. I mean, it might have been 300 fans, but I thought, well, this is odd because most of the players thought, you know, they only looked at the girls,
the girls,
either as they could bed them down, or just someone that was taking up our gym
objects,
time.
Objects,
yes, exactly.
Objects.
Or using our gym time, or
sure.
our equipment, or our trainers, or that kind of thing. But he was genuinely interested in the women's team, and that came from the girls, the bridge between the boys and girls teams at Marshall.
He is a remarkable guy, Sean Harrington, as you discover in this book. We got to take a little commercial break, but I'm going to keep Russ Bradford here for the entire hour to talk about all the dreams we've dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side, because it is an essential book for any Chicago bookshelf. Talking to Russ Bradbird about his astonishing book, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. It is a story, and we will get to it, of sort of an astonishing, courageous move that had tragic, I think, consequences, but there is a great deal of hope also in this book. You and Sean Harrington, who you recruited from Marshall High School to play in New Mexico, sort of drifted apart in August 1996, and you didn't see him again for 20 years. Did you hear of him? Did you keep tabs on him?
No, not at all. And, you know, it's one of the things that happens in major college sports is that, you know, the players come and players go. And he had somewhat of an unhappy ending at New Mexico State. He led the team in scoring,
right,
steals, and assists, but he blew out his knee. And so there's parts of the book, Rick, that we just don't agree on. And one of the parts we don't agree on is I feel like we did not renew his scholarship and didn't bring him back. But it was all done through innuendo. Don't you remember your high school girlfriend sort of stopped talking to you, and you saw her with that other fella?
Yeah.
And then you went to her and said, look, I've decided we're going to break up.
Right, sure.
But she'd already broken up with you. And my feeling was that we'd signed a couple players at his position, and he came to us and said, I think I'm going to transfer to Northwest Missouri. And we said, well, good luck.
Yeah.
And we didn't try to talk him into staying. Clearly we made a mistake. I mean, he went to Northwest Missouri, and he was the most valuable player in the entire conference. But I didn't talk to him until I'd heard that his mother was killed in 2003, which we can talk about. But
when he killed, how?
Well, she went to check on the neighbors, just looking in on the neighbors, and there was a home invasion in progress. Uh-huh. They had people duct taped, laying on the floor, hands tied behind their back. She tried to run out the house, and the people in the house miraculously lived, but she didn't. They shot her. You know, she was shot trying to escape from the house. She was exactly my age. I think she was 43 when she died, something like that, 48 maybe.
Yeah. Could Sean have used that later college experience to perhaps, as many non-NBA players, of which there are millions of non-NBA players, to play in Europe, to have a career in basket as a player?
Absolutely. He was good enough to play. You know, we'd gone to Australia as a team.
Which yeah,
Australia,
right.
Australia was one of the few countries that has American point guards. So he could have gone overseas, I'm certain of it. But his college girlfriend turned up, high school girlfriend turned up pregnant. And he did what we always stress to young men to do in our society.
Do the right thing.
Go be a good father to your... So rather than go overseas and play, rather than leave Chicago, he came back to Chicago to be a good father to his daughter.
All right. Before I get to what happened to Sean in 2014 and what then brought you two back together in a much different relationship, what fascinates me about the book is your initial relationship is coach and high school kid, and the later relationship is author and subject, two vastly different kinds of relationships. Is he upset? Does he filled with recriminations about doing the right thing and coming back to Chicago? Is this? It doesn't seem as if he's a guy who would beat himself up too much about that.
I don't think so. I think, you know, it's a common question, Rick, is people have asked me, why did he come back to Chicago if he didn't have to? He had a degree, and why doesn't he get off the West Side? And the answer I always give about that is that, you know, Martin Luther King might still be alive today if he'd have just moved to Seattle and been a used car salesman instead of, you know, or if he'd have sold insurance in Atlanta and got out of the whole preaching business. And so I do think what he did, I think in many ways what Sean did before he ever saved his daughter's life in 2014, I think what he did when he came back in 1998 was heroic. He came back to the West Side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and to sort of help and nurture and foster and do the right thing, not only by the child he had and by the woman who had that child, but by the people growing up in that neighborhood.
That's right, and by the kids at Marshall High School, and so I think there's an element of heroism just in that, in going back.
No question.
And not everybody on the West Side can move off the West Side.
Yeah, no. I mean, as you well know.
And he grew up in grinding poverty. You know, he'd lived in five or six different homes by the time he ever went to high school. Although I think one of the great things that he's had in his life is his mother was a really wonderful lady.
But he also, in that short time, and we both know what has happened to the West Side and various portions of the South Side in these years, it's not gotten any better. I mean, he's going to New Mexico and then somewhere else to play basketball. By the time he came back, it's the same place and maybe worse.
That's right. That's
more
right.
Disenfranchised.
That's right. But I also think the other element, I think, Rick, is that home is still home. You know, and I think that I think that's part of it too. Is even though he's never had any interest in applying at other schools, or he loves Marshall, and he loves the neighborhood, and he loves those kids, and it would never occur to him to go be the coach at South Shore High School,
yeah,
or a suburban high school, or Fenwick Catholic, or that kind of thing. It just wouldn't occur to him because he's so loyal to Marshall and to his neighborhood.
Well, you were a part. He spent time there he was a teacher's aide and a basketball coach, and he knew that school as well as he knew the palm of his hand. He couldn't find his car on January 14, 2014. What happened to him?
Well, his car was stolen by a Marshall student, and so the stolen car led to him, he wound up in a rental car, and a couple weeks later, in the rental car, driving his daughter to Westinghouse High School, then he would drop the daughter off at Westinghouse and go on to Marshall, but he's in a rental car, just a nondescript, common, four-door white, sedan, and it's 7:30 in the morning, and these guys run up, it's just mistaken identity, they thought he was somebody else, ran up to his car at the corner of Augusta and Hamlin, pretty close to what would be Division and Pulaski.
Yeah.
Pretty close to Orr High School, actually, which is Chicago and Pulaski. But ran up to his car and just opened fire. And he dove on top of his daughter, pushes her down, and a bullet goes through her headrest. So she undoubtedly would have been shot in the face. But he takes two bullets. He takes two bullets, one in the back. And he knew that something was wrong, and that was one of the really amazing parts of the story, is the daughter said, are we shot? Are we shot? She was panicked and yelling. There's glass all over the place, glass in her hair. And he says, no, we're fine, which I think is a really, really – first there's the pushing her down to get her out of the way, get her out of the line of fire and covering her body, but also calming her and saying –
Well, the courage is both physical and emotional in this case. I mean, it's really stunning to me the way you capture it, too.
You're fine. Let's call your mother and, call your mom, tell her we're fine. Let's call 911, that kind of thing. But even then, he could feel his legs floating up felt like his legs were floating up. The car wound up bouncing over the curb across the street, and he could have got T-boned. He was lucky not to get hit again.
And he is severely damaged.
That's right. He's paralyzed from the waist down. Although occasionally, it's exciting for him. He gets hunger pangs now, and occasionally his foot will twitch or his leg will twitch. I think he still holds out hope. And, with medical technology these days, anything is possible. But it appears that he's paralyzed.
You heard about this.
Yes. It was all over the radio.
And then you decided to do what?
Well, I texted him, which is about the dumbest thing you can do to somebody who's been shot and is in the hospital, as if people want to get a text from a coach they haven't seen
coach
in 20 years.
Coach you haven't seen or talked to in 20 years.
But then, after about a week, what did your text say? I said, big love from New Mexico. I'm teaching down at New Mexico
State,
where I used to coach. And about a week later, I just said, well, I'll just call him. And he answered the phone. It surprised me. And he said that Dorothy Gators, the famous girls coach, was putting on a benefit game. And I just blurted it out. I'll be there.
I'm in.
Not knowing what I was getting into. And so I spent the first year, I had this idea that, I've met you before, and I know some media people in Chicago and some basketball media people. And I had the idea that if we can get people to write about his story, that will help with the fundraising, because I knew, you know, his paychecks got cut off after 90
right,
days.
Right, I know that the bureaucracy at the public school system is really...
And they're, in fairness, they're not under the same, because he's not a teacher, he's an educational support personnel,
right.
So he's under a different, he's with a different union, and so his paychecks got cut off pretty quickly, and my idea was, I'll advocate for him. I'll bang on doors, and the more that it got ignored, you know, Dan McGrath was good. He wrote a piece about it. Dawn Trice Turner. She wrote a nice piece, but in general, it was just ignored. And I had people tell me, "This is a good story."
Why I was ignored? Yeah,
because it happens all the time.
Yeah,
and this is a good story.
Well, a black guy getting shot.
Yes.
And that's, we'll talk about that. I know you're intrigued by all this, and as am I. All the dreams we've dreamed. Story of Hoops, Handguns on Chicago's West Side. I will continue my conversation with Russ Bradbird about his remarkable book and, indeed, this remarkable story. Russ Bradbird is in here for 20 more minutes. He and I will be with Sean Harrington at the Printers Row Lit Fest this coming Saturday in Jones College Prep in the third floor library, which is a really nice space, and I so look forward to meeting Sean and asking him, as I'm asking you, did you do him justice? It's a tough book. I mean, it's a tough... You came back, you wanted to go to a benefit for him, you wanted to try to help him in a way, and then all of a sudden you started saying, wait a minute, maybe I should write... And the story is unbelievably compelling. I would have thought the same thing, but you're biting off a lot in doing this.
Well, I think sometimes we can't write about things because we're too close. You know, when the Herman Cogan biography comes out, it won't be Rick Cogan that does it, I don't think, would it?
No.
Okay.
The Rick Cogan autobiography comes out, that's not going to be either.
I just thought I was too close to the situation.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But I kept trying to advocate for him and trying to get publicity for him. And when I finally sat down with Alex Kotlowitz, you know Alex.
Oh, of course.
And
there are no children.
Alex finally said to me, he sort of put me on the spot, and he made me pretty uncomfortable the way a good interviewer can sometimes. And he said, well, you know, finally he said, you know, you say that you wake up in the morning thinking about Sean, you go to bed at night thinking, what can I do to help him tomorrow? Why don't you write this yourself?
Uh-huh.
And by that point, I had pages and pages of notes, and I had been trying to write a magazine piece because I thought maybe
someone... Did you move back to Chicago by then?
No. I teach at New Mexico State, but I live in Ravenswood in the summers. We have a tiny apartment, and we have a great situation. We rent it out to graduate students during the year, and we leave sheets and blankets and coffee cups and everything and just move in for 3 months in the summer. So I've been coming back. It was the thing that I missed most about coaching is it took me away from Chicago.
Yeah.
But when I started teaching, when I got out of coaching, we got this tiny apartment there, and it pays the mortgage, the renters. But Kotlowitz had said to me, "Why don't you write it yourself?" And it seemed obvious. You know, now it seems obvious. Looking back at the time, I was resisting, and didn't think I was. It just seemed like a lot of work, and it's also, boy, it's not the happiest story in the world.
Either. No, it's not. And to dig deeper into Ravenswood is, although you do know the city, Russ Bradbird, very, very well, but Ravenswood is a vastly different neighborhood.
No,
you would drive
leafy.
Your bike down. I mean, you would ride your bike down.
Yes,
I would commute.
Yes, I was cycling from Ravenswood to after Sean was shot, after he was paralyzed, he moved in with an aunt in Oak Park. But I'd have to, you know, there's no easy way to get to Oak Park, and on the bike, it's a bit of a haul. But yeah, so I was cycling, but you know, I've got my bright yellow vest and my bright yellow helmet and my lights. I look like
a crazy person. Construction worker or a lunatic.
I look like a nut.
Yeah.
And so no one ever, I'm like a rolling pinball machine.
But in doing this, too, you got some incredible insights that you write in here. I'm going to read something you wrote, if you don't mind. You write, many Chicagoans ignore the situation, meaning the situation of violence in certain neighborhoods here, or tune it out as I once did in order to simply move forward and not spend their days weeping in a closet. On the West Side, that's impossible. There, violence can't be contained in the morning paper or the nightly news. To most of those in safe neighborhoods, the epidemic over there and to them and is an acceptable level of violence. Did you feel terribly removed from the reality of neighborhoods like Austin and Garfield Park and West Garfield.
Well,
of course you did.
Now that I'm not coaching. Yeah, now that I'm not coaching anymore. Yeah. I had no reason to go over there anymore.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think that's it. I do think that's it is an acceptable level of violence in America and in Chicago, or else we would stop it.
Well, in the course of this book, you also write about other Marshall students and basketball players who fell victim.
You remember, Rick, I bet you remember the great writer Grace Paley,
absolutely,
who wound up in jail a half dozen times for protesting this and that. But she said once that you don't really have a story until you have two stories.
Yeah.
When in the Sean Harrington story, I was working on it about a year after Sean was shot, Tim Triplett, the star player for Marshall, was murdered.
Yeah.
And that's when the book really, it almost spun out of control, but that's when it really took off, I think. He said Triplett was a really compelling and charismatic guy, and his story was very much like Sean. He'd had a parent murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been
his
father had been murdered, then his brother had been murdered, and he had bounced around a lot as a kid, but he was a energetic, talented point guard, very much like Sean was. Sean wasn't quite as cocky as Tim Triplett was, but what made Tim Triplett a great player, the theory that I come up with in the book is that was his undoing also. You know, Sean could turn it on and off.
Yeah.
And many of the great ones can. You know, I worked for Lou Henson for a few years.
Sure, sure, sure.
And Lou, as soon as the game was over, he was hugging everybody and smiling and shaking hands. In the game, he was like George Foreman. You know, George Foreman seems like the nicest person in the world. He'd try and knock your head off.
Yeah, exactly.
He'd
try to kill you.
And I think with Tim Triplett, that was when the book really sort of really took off, and there was these two stories. Here was Sean Harry, you know, Tim Triplett had this secret life. He was trying to make ends meet on the street, but was also a great player. And soon after Triplett was killed, one Marshall player after another was killed. As 10 days ago, Rick, no, 2 weeks ago, a kid named Cedric Williams was killed, and he'd played 3 years in Marshall. That makes the seventh Marshall player killed in a three-year period.
Well, Triplett is a compelling person, too. There's just one section where you talk about his postings on Facebook that started to sort of, it was a manifestation of him going a little
He was conflicted. I mean, on the one hand, he loved basketball, he loved his girlfriend, he loved his mother. But, you know, but there was no money, and I think the street life sort of gave him access to money that he wouldn't have had. But part of it, I think, what was so compelling about Triplett to Sean Harrington is that he spotted him pretty early, thought, this guy's going to be a coach. He's smart, and he's talented, and he's outspoken. Even before he got eligible at Marshall, there's no vocal leader on the team who's not playing in the game. If you watch Chris Paul, when he was hurt for the Rockets a week or two ago, sure, he talks to the refs a little bit and that, but he's not trying to run the team. Triplett was trying to run the team.
Wow, interesting. So Sean had, you write, and some of the stuff in this book, Russ, is so chilling. When you write here, Sean was in a rut. The $850 a day rehab price tag was no longer covered by Sean's insurance company. Fearful of draining his savings, he stopped going. That meant he could not get approved by doctors to return to work at a job he could no longer do. That is one of the saddest paragraphs I can remember.
It was a real catch-22. He couldn't get his health insurance to kick in again until he started work, and he couldn't work because he couldn't do the rehab, so he was sort of stuck in this rut. And that's one of the things, that one of the angles of the book in All the Dreams We've Dreamed, Rick, is Tim Triplett had a secret life. He was a basketball star that was doing things at night that he probably shouldn't have been doing. Sean Harrington has a secret life, too. He knows Shaquille O'Neal, he knows Nolan Richardson, he knows Tim Hardaway, but most days he's stuck in his apartment.
Yeah.
Can't get out. And I think his secret life is the real great challenge, I think, for him is the endurance to go on for the next 30 years.
How's his daughter?
She's good, but she's had ups and downs, too.
Well, I'll bet. The PTSD that I'm no doctor, but both of these two must be suffering that at some level, yes?
I think one of the things that I had hoped, and I think a lot of people had hoped, is that if Sean will just get better one day, But it's that doesn't, you know, that doesn't. Yeah, it's going to be with him for the, of course, this incident will be with him for the rest of his life. And I think for the daughter, too, you know, she was number three in her high school class when the shooting happened, and her grades dipped all the way to 3.5. Well, you know, so not terribly.
Yeah, but
I mean, she's a remarkable kid as well. And that's, if you remember this part in the book, you know, she's shy and she's not as outgoing or as boisterous as Sean is. But then at the trial, she sort of saved
right,
the day.
Right. All the Dreams We've Dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side by Russ Bradbird. It is an unbelievable story. He and I will be at the Printers Row Lit Fest this coming Saturday, third floor library at Jones College Prep, further talking about this, and I will get to meet Sean, and Russ and I will continue the conversation after a short commercial break, during which I will first tell you, Steve is giving away a Centennial Blue Chevy Silverado truck. Have they let Sandberg take a spin behind the wheel yet? Tune in tomorrow at 7:20 a.m. for details. Welcome back. I have only 10 more minutes left with Russ Bradbird talking about his remarkable book, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. It is a story of tragedy, but I also think one of some hope in telling these stories, and you're telling about the number of kids at Marshall, in addition to Sean Harrington, who had been shot and killed in that neighborhood. You quote Arne Duncan in this book, the former head of schools here and the former head of education for the Obama administration. One day he sent you three texts that combined said this, quote, Black lives don't matter. We can say they do, but our collective actions don't match the words. In fact, quite the opposite. If these were white folks being killed in Chicago, everything would change. You believe that, Russ?
I think it's true. I think that, you know, one of the things I've struggled with, you know, trying to explain to friends the Black Lives Matter situation, and I do think that nothing ruins a neighborhood more than an unsolved murder, unless it's the closing of a school.
Or 50 schools.
Yeah, 50 yeah. schools, yeah. yes. And so in this case, though, you know, Sean's shooters were caught pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But he was a celebrity, you know, comparatively.
He's a
high school basketball star and a coach and that kind of thing. Of the other seven players who have been killed, there's no arrests that have ever been made, even with Tim Triplett. I started off. I've become much more sympathetic to the cops than I was when I started the book.
Sure.
But when there's unsolved murders, you know, that's where the whole Black Lives Matter thing manifests itself to me, is that let's solve these murders if those lives mattered. And I think the truth of it, Rick, is it's poor black people.
Oh yeah.
If this was happening to Oak Park kids or Evanston kids, it would be a very different story.
You spent enough time in these neighborhoods, Russ, to know that there are neighborhoods in Chicago that are disenfranchised, and you could convince someone, take them there blindfold, you'd convince them they were in rural Mississippi in the 60s.
Well, one of the things I tried not to do in the book was, you know, to offer solutions. I thought the book would just get totally too big. It would be 700 pages if I tried to offer solutions, and so I don't want to offer solutions. But now on the West Side today, 80% of the kids don't go to their neighborhood school.
I know,
and that's a kind of craziness. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if things were bad
Duncan.
For me at Von Steuben, my mother knocked on the principal's door and said, "My son can't pass his Spanish class."
And for Arne Duncan's great quotes in the book and also his great jacket quote, I mean, Arne's a big believer in charter schools, and I'm not a big believer in charter schools.
No, I'm not
schools,
either, and I've never challenged him on that. And that was actually part of the – when I finally got through to Arne Duncan, I thought, should I challenge him on this charter school stuff, or do I just try and help Sean Harrington? And I just thought, all right, Russ,
the wise choice. And I think another wise choice you made is in trying to offer solutions. Many of these problems are deep seated.
Yes.
They're not. I'm not going to say they're insoluble, but they are so deep seated. And these neighborhoods have been so disenfranchised that, okay, if you and I were Bill Gates and we could go build factories and put people to work, and maybe in a few generations this might be some kind of what you have done and the cover really captures it too. You've written about the desperation and hopelessness, but also the courage.
Yes.
That exists in these neighborhoods.
Well, and I think if there's any redemption in the book, it's, you know, in Sean Harrington's courage and endurance. But also, you know, I remember, and I write about this in the book, I spent a full day at Marshall one day, and one of the first things I saw was the cops tasering a kid. Have you ever seen anyone get tasered?
Oh, yeah.
It's shocking.
Oh, it's horrifying.
I mean, well, there's a pun there, sorry.
Yeah.
But
it's horrifying.
Was really surprising, and it really rattled me. And I thought, why would anybody send their kid here? And I'd been to Marshall dozens of times at that point, but
Marshall's not the worst.
No, but every kid who walked by in the hallway, a teacher spoke to that kid and knew every kid's first name. Hey, Joe. Hello, Diane. Hey, Stacy. Yeah. They knew every kid. Every teacher knew every kid by first name. And all, you know, there's a whole crew of people at Marshall that have no interest in getting better jobs at better schools. They love Marshall and love those kids.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you experienced that, because I'm not gonna lie, I know a lot of teachers out there, and they are the ones fighting the good fight. Because you asked yourself, why did Sean Harrington come back to the West Side? Why do these people stay? Why do these people go to work on the West Side?
Yes.
It is because they are optimistic. They are hopeful. They see in a kid reading his first poem, they see something bright in their eyes.
That's right. That's right. People have commended me for saying, well, it's really great what you've done for Sean. But what I did for Sean, I think there's people, that's why I don't want to try to appear to be an expert. There's people who have dedicated their lives to helping.
Yeah.
They're called Chicago public school teachers.
Exactly. You don't come off as an expert here.
Yeah.
You come off as a storyteller You have found a very, very compelling character upon which to, and a heroic character upon which to hang this story, which is a much bigger story that, you know, there is no, you know, there was a, you know, in the days of, you know, Isaiah Thomas, there was a way out. Or so there seemed.
Yes.
There doesn't seem to be that way anymore.
No,
I'm sure there's some kid who's going to, you know, who's going to beat the odds, but, you know, that whole...
But even that, with the chances of getting a basketball scholarship are no matter how hard you work. And so we need other things besides basketball for kids to latch on to. I love the movie Hoop Dreams, and I watched it again for about the fifth time last summer.
Sure.
It holds up. But the one thing that worries me about Hoop Dreams, I think people who don't know the neighborhood see it and think, isn't it great? Basketball gave these kids a way out. But the truth is that most kids aren't going to be good enough basketball players.
Well, most kids, it's the fast.
Yes,
fast.
99% of the kids are not getting scholarships.
Yeah, let alone playing in the
I can't wait for you to meet Sean Harrington
NBA.
In Printer's Row.
How is he now?
Well, it's been...
And how is he? What does he think of the book? And did you two... this is a, in a sense, not a classic collaboration, but it's a collaborative effort here, I think.
Well, he never saw the book till I was done.
And I
did that on purpose because I knew there would be things that he didn't like in the book. Hey, he doesn't think he's a hero. He says, I did what any parent would do, but I'd like to think I would react like that, but I don't know if I would. I don't know if I would. I don't think we know how we would react till the bullets start flying, but I think it's the struggles have continued for him. I think he's anxious about his two daughters, you know, mm-hmm. he's anxious about the daughters, and he wants to, you know, Arnie Duncan helped him get that restorative justice counselor job at Marshall, but he's had health reasons, and he's battled depression a little bit, and he hasn't been working full-time, so he's hoping to go back to work full-time in September.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. I cannot wait to meet him. Again, Russ and I will be with the aforementioned Sean Harrington, I'm going to call him a hero. You can do whatever he wants to me. I'll call him a hero in the book. And at the third floor library at Jones College Prep as part of the Printer's Row Lit Fest, which takes place all weekend, Saturday and Sunday. We will be at Saturday at 1 o'clock, third floor library at Jones College Prep. It is a space filled with light, and I hope that light is coming into Sean Harrington's life. Where does he live now?
He's on the edge of the West Side. He's in Oak Park and lives with his aunt. And so that's part of the difficulty too. Is I think that's the next step for him. He can't get in and out of the apartment on his own. And so I think that's the next step. Is we've got to figure out a way to somehow get him with an elevator covered parking.
Yeah.
You know, that because he has a van now. He has a wheelchair-accessible van.
You may have split apart for 20 years, you two guys, you and Sean Harrington, but I figure now, Russ Bradbird, you and he are tied at the hip forever.
Well, that's what Conroy said, is, you know, when I had lunch with John Conroy a couple weeks ago, he had mentioned that. And I hope so too. You know, I say this at the end of the book, is that like any coach, I had done poorly by him, I think, for many years, and I think like any coach, you know, I want the next season to start.
You've done right by him in this book. This is just a remarkable book. All the dreams we've dreamed, story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. I will add to that alliterative title, story of hoops and handguns and hope. I will also add on Chicago's West Side. I will see you Saturday.
Great, Rick.
Rest up.
Okay.
We'll do the same. Why don't we just sit there and we'll play portions of this and let Sean talk?
Yeah. Well, wait till you meet. He's a good talker, too.
I can't wait. I just can't wait. I'm so glad he's coming to this thing, too. Once again, at Jones College Prep, Saturday, 1 o'clock in the library on the third floor. It will be the three of us talking further about this. I can't wait to meet him. And you've done him proud here, and I'm going to tell him that, too.
Thank you a lot, Rick.
My pleasure. That's it for the show. I don't know where we'll be next week. I'll be at Roger Badish's house doing the show live from there.
Yeah.
Aubrey Mumpower, thanks for engineering. Ben Anderson, thanks for producing. Roger Badish, thanks for just being here. Where'd that guy go? There was a guy out here for like an hour.
You lost your audience.
Well, maybe he's waiting someplace in a secret.
He went to buy a book.
Darker corner. Yeah, one would hope. One could only hope. So tune in next week. I'll see you then.